Home. Driving home was exciting that day because there was so much to talk about. Royal had thrown a ring over one of the black and white striped canes, and he had it. Alice had spent a nickel for peppermint candy. She broke the striped stick in two, and each had a piece to suck slowly. It seemed strange to be at home only long enough to do the chores and sleep. Early next morning, they were driving away again. There were two more days of the fair. This morning, Almanzo and Father went quickly past the stock sheds to the display of vegetables and grains. Almanzo caught sight of the pumpkins at once. They shone out brightly, golden among all the duller things. And there was Almanzo's pumpkin, the largest of them all. "Now don't be too sure of getting the prize, son," Father said. "It isn't size that counts as much as quality." Almanzo tried not to care too much about the prize. He went away from the pumpkins with Father, though he couldn't help looking back at his pumpkin now and then. He saw the fine potatoes, the beets, turnips, rutabagas, and onions. He fingered the brown, plump kernels of wheat and the grooved, pale oats, the Canada peas and navy beans and speckled beans. He looked at ears of white corn and yellow corn and red, white, and blue corn. Father pointed out how closely the kernels grew on the best ears, how they covered even the tip of the cob. People walked slowly up and down, looking. There were always some people looking at the pumpkins, and Almanzo wished they knew that the biggest pumpkin was his. After dinner, he hurried back to watch the judging. The crowds were larger now, and sometimes he had to leave Father and squirm between people to see what the judges were doing. The three judges wore badges on their coats. They were solemn and talked together in low voices so that no one heard what they said. They weighed the grains in their hands and looked at them closely. They chewed a few grains of wheat and of oats to see how they tasted. They split open peas and beans, and they shelled a few kernels off of each ear of corn to make sure how long the kernels were. With their jackknives, they cut the onions in two and the potatoes. They cut very thin slices of the potatoes and held them up to the light. The best part of a potato is next to the skin, and you can see how thick the best part is if you hold a very thin slice to the light and look through it. The thickest crowd pressed around the table where the judges were and watched without saying anything. There wasn't a sound when at last the tall, thin judge with the chin whiskers took a snip of red ribbon and a snip of blue ribbon out of his pocket. The red ribbon was second prize, the blue one was first prize. The judge put them on the vegetables that had won them, and the crowd breathed a long breath. Then all at once everybody talked. Almanzo saw that people who didn't get any prize and the person who got second prize all congratulated the winner. If his pumpkin didn't get a prize, he would have to do that. He didn't want to, but he guessed he must. At last the judges came to the pumpkins. Almanzo tried to look as if he didn't care much, but he felt hot all over. The judges had to wait till Mr. Paddock brought them a big, sharp butcher knife. The biggest judge took it and thrust it with all his might into a pumpkin. He bore down hard on the handle and cut a thick slice out. He held it up, and all the judges looked at the thick yellow flesh of the pumpkin. They looked at the thickness of the hard rind, and at the little hollow where the seeds were. They cut tiny slices and tasted them. Then the big judge cut open another pumpkin. He had begun with the smallest. The crowd pressed tight against Almanzo. He had to open his mouth to get his breath. At last, the judge cut open Almanzo's big pumpkin. Almanzo felt dizzy. The inside of his pumpkin had a big hollow for seeds, but it was a big pumpkin. It had lots of seeds. Its flesh was a little paler than the other pumpkins. Almanzo didn't know whether that made any difference or not. The judges tasted it. He could not tell from their faces how it tasted. Then they talked together for a long time. He could not hear what they said. The tall, thin judge shook his head and tugged his whiskers. He cut a thin slice from the yellowest pumpkin and a thin slice from Almanzo's pumpkin and tasted them. He gave them to the big judge, and he tasted them. The fat judge said something, and they all smiled. Mr. Paddock leaned over the table and said,
"Good afternoon, Wilder. You and the boy are taken in the sight, I see.
Having a good time, Almanzo?" Almanzo could hardly speak. He managed to say, "Yes, sir." The tall judge had taken the red ribbon and the blue ribbon out of his pocket. The fat judge took hold of his sleeve, and all the judges put their heads together again. The tall judge turned around slowly. Slowly he took a pin from his lapel and stuck it through the blue ribbon. He was not very near Almanzo's big pumpkin. He was not near enough it to reach it. He held out the blue ribbon above another pumpkin. He leaned and stretched out his arm slowly, and he thrust the pin into Almanzo's pumpkin. Father's hand clapped on Almanzo's shoulder. All at once Almanzo could breathe, and he was tingling all over. Mr. Paddock was shaking his hand. All the judges were smiling. Ever so many people said, "Well, well, Mr. Wilder, so your boy's got first prize." Mr. Webb said, "That's a fine pumpkin, Almanzo. Don't know as I ever saw a finer." Mr. Paddock said, "I never saw a pumpkin that beat it for size. How'd you raise such a big pumpkin, Almanzo?" Suddenly, everything seemed big and very still. Almanzo felt cold and small and scared. He hadn't thought before that maybe it wasn't fair to get a prize for a milk-fed pumpkin. Maybe the prize was for raising pumpkins in the ordinary way. Maybe, if he told, they'd take the prize away from him. They might think he had tried to cheat. He looked at Father, but Father's face didn't tell him what to do. I kept hoeing it, and," he said. Then he knew he was telling a lie. Father was hearing him tell a lie. He looked up at Mr. Paddock and said, "I raised it on milk. It's a milk-fed pumpkin. Is that all right?"
"Yes, that's all right," Mr. Paddock answered. Father laughed. "There's tricks in all trades but ours, Paddock. And maybe a few tricks in farming and wagon-making, too, eh?" Then Almanzo knew how foolish he had been. Father knew all about the pumpkin, and Father wouldn't cheat. Afterward, he went walking with Father among the crowds. They saw the horses again, and the colt that won the prize was not so good as Starlight. Almanzo did hope that Father would bring Starlight to the fair next year. Then they watched the foot races, and the jumping contests, and the throwing contests. Malone boys were in them, but the farmer boys won almost every time. Almanzo kept remembering his prize pumpkin and feeling good. Driving home that night, they all felt good. Alice's wool work had won first prize, and Eliza Jane had a red ribbon, and Alice had a blue ribbon for jellies. Father said the Wilder family had done itself proud that day. There was another day of the fair, but it wasn't so much fun. Almanzo was tired of having a good time. 3 days of it were too much. It didn't seem right to be dressed up again and leaving the farm. He felt unsettled, as he did at house-cleaning time. He was glad when the fair was over and everything could go on as usual. Fall of the Year. "Winds in the north," Father said at breakfast, "and clouds coming up. We better get the beech nuts in before it snows." The beech trees grew in the timber lot, 2 miles away by the road, but only half a mile across the fields. Mr. Webb was a good neighbor and let Father drive across his land. Almanzo and Royal put on their caps and warm coats. Alice put on her cloak and hood, and they rode away with Father in the wagon to gather the beech nuts. When they came to a stone fence, Almanzo helped to take it down and let the wagon go through. The pastures were empty now. All the stock was in the warm barn so they could leave the fences down until the last trip home.
In the beech grove, all the yellow leaves had fallen. They lay thick on the ground beneath the slim trunks and delicate bare limbs of the beeches. The beech nuts had fallen after the leaves and lay on top of them. Father and Royal lifted the matted leaves carefully on their pitchforks and put them, nuts and all, into the wagon. And Alice and Almanzo ran up and down in the wagon, trampling down the rustling leaves to make room for more. When the wagon was full, Royal drove away with Father to the barns, but Almanzo and Alice stayed to play till the wagon came back. A chill wind was blowing, and the sunlight was hazy. Squirrels frisked about, storing away nuts for the winter. High in the sky, the wild ducks were honking, hurrying south. It was a wonderful day for playing wild Indian all among the trees. When Almanzo was tired of playing Indian, he and Alice sat on a log and cracked beech nuts with their teeth. Beech nuts are three-cornered and shiny brown and small, but every shell is solidly full of meat. They are so good that nobody could ever eat enough of them. At least Almanzo never got tired of eating them before the wagon came back. Then he and Alice trampled down leaves again, while the busy pitchforks made the patch of bare ground larger and larger. It took almost all day to gather all the beech nuts. In the cold twilight, Almanzo helped to lay up the stone fences behind the last load. All the beech nuts and their leaves made a big pile on the south barn floor, beside the fanning mill. That night, Father said, they'd seen the last of Indian summer. "It will snow tonight," he said. Sure enough, when Almanzo woke next morning, the light had a snowy look, and from the window he saw the ground and barn roof white with snow. Father was pleased. The soft snow was 6 inches deep, but the ground was not yet frozen. Poor man's fertilizer, Father called such a snow, and he set Royal to plowing it into all the fields. It carried something from the air into the ground that would make the crops grow. Meanwhile, Almanzo helped Father. They tightened the barn's wooden windows and nailed down every board that had loosened in the summer's sun and rain. They banked the walls of the barn with straw from the stalls, and they banked the walls of the house with clean, bright straw. They laid stones on the straw to hold it snug against winds. They fitted storm doors and storm windows on the house just in time. That week ended with the first hard freeze. Bitter cold weather had come to stay, and now it was butchering time. In the cold dawn before breakfast, Almanzo helped Royal set up the big iron cauldron near the barn. They set it on stones and filled it with water and lighted a bonfire under it. It held 3 barrels of water. Before they had finished, Lazy John and French Joe had come, and there was time to snatch only a bite of breakfast. 5 hogs and a yearling beef were to be killed that day. As soon as one was killed, Father and Joe and John dipped the carcass into the boiling cauldron and heaved it out and laid it on boards. With butcher knives, they scraped all the hair off it. Then they hung it up by the hind feet in a tree and cut it open and took all the insides out into a tub. Almanzo and Royal carried the tub to the kitchen, and Mother and the girls washed the heart and liver and snipped off all the bits of fat from the hog's insides to make lard. Father and Joe skinned the beef carefully. The hide came off in one big piece. Every year Father killed a beef and saved the hide to make shoes. All that afternoon the men were cutting up the meat, and Almanzo and Royal were hurrying to put it all away. All the pieces of fat pork they packed in salt, in barrels down cellar. The hams and shoulders they slid carefully into barrels of brown pork pickle, which Mother had made of salt, maple sugar, saltpeter, and water boiled together. Pork pickle had a stinging smell that felt like a sneeze. Spare ribs, backbones, hearts, livers, tongues, and all the sausage meat had to go into the woodshed attic. Father and Joe hung the quarters of beef there, too. The meat would freeze in the attic, and stay frozen all winter. Butchering was finished that night. French Joe and Lazy John went whistling home with fresh meat to pay for their work, and Mother baked spare ribs for supper. Almanza loved to gnaw the meat from the long, curved, flat bones. He liked the brown pork gravy, too, on the creamy mashed potatoes. All the next week, Mother and the girls were hard at work, and Mother kept Almanza in the kitchen to help. They cut up the pork fat and boiled it in big kettles on the stove. When it was done, Mother strained the clear hot lard through white cloths into big stone jars. Crumbling brown cracklings were left inside the cloth after Mother squeezed it, and Almanzo sneaked a few and ate them whenever he could. Mother said they were too rich for him. She put them away to be used for seasoning cornbread. Then she made the head cheese. She boiled the 6 heads till the meat came off the bones. She chopped it and seasoned it and mixed it with liquor from the boiling and poured it into 6-quart pans. When it was cold, it was like jelly, for a gelatin had come out of the bones. Next, Mother made mincemeat. She boiled the best bits of beef and pork and chopped them fine. She mixed in raisins and spices, sugar and vinegar, chopped apples and brandy, and she packed 2 big jars full of mincemeat. It smelled delicious, and she let Almanzo eat the scraps left in the mixing bowl. All this time he was grinding sausage meat. He poked thousands of pieces of meat into the grinder and turned the handle round and round for hours and hours. He was glad when that was finished. Mother seasoned the meat and molded it into big balls, and Almanzo had to carry all those balls into the woodshed attic and pile them up on clean cloths. They would be there, frozen, all winter, and every morning Mother would mold one ball into little cakes and fry them for breakfast. The end of butchering time was candle making. Mother scrubbed the big lard kettles and filled them with bits of beef fat. Beef fat doesn't make lard. It melts into tallow. While it was melting, Almanzo helped string the candle molds. A candle mold was 2 rows of tin tubes fastened together and standing straight up on 6 feet. There were 12 tubes in a mold. They were open at the top, but tapered to a point at the bottom, and in each point there was a tiny hole. Mother cut a length of candle wicking for each tube. She doubled the wicking across a small stick and twisted it into a cord. She licked her thumb and finger and rolled the end of the cord into a sharp point. When she had 6 cords on the stick, she dropped them into the 6 tubes, and the stick lay on top of the tubes. The points of the cords came through the tiny holes in the points of the tubes, and Almanzo pulled each one tight and held it by sticking a raw potato on the tube's sharp point. When every tube had its wick held straight and tight down its middle, Mother carefully poured the hot tallow. She filled every tube to the top. Then Almanzo set the mold outdoors to cool. When the tallow was hard, he brought the mold in. He pulled off the potatoes. Mother dipped the whole mold quickly into the boiling water and lifted the sticks. 6 candles came up on each stick. Then Almanzo cut them off the stick. He trimmed the ends of wicking off the flat ends, and he left just enough wicking to light on each pointed end, and he piled the smooth, straight candles in waxy white piles. All one day Almanzo helped Mother make candles. That night they had made enough candles to last till butchering time next year. Cobbler. Mother was worrying and scolding because the cobbler had not come. Almanzo's moccasins were worn to rags, and Royal had outgrown last year's boots. He had slit them all around to get his feet in them. Their feet ached with cold, but nothing could be done until the cobbler came. It was almost time for Royal and Eliza Jane and Alice to go to the academy, and they had no shoes. And still, the cobbler didn't come. Mother's shears went snickety-snick through the web of beautiful sheep's gray cloth she had woven. She cut and fitted and basted and sewed, and she made Royal a handsome new suit with a great coat to match. She made him a cap with flaps that buttoned, like button caps. For Eliza Jane, she made a new dress of wine-colored cloth, and she made Alice a new dress of indigo blue. The girls were ripping their old dresses and bonnets, sponging and pressing them and sewing them together again the other side out to look like new. In the evenings, Mother's knitting needles flashed and clicked, making new stockings for them all. She knitted so fast that the needles got hot from rubbing together, but they could not have new shoes unless the cobbler came in time. He didn't come. The girls' skirts hid their old shoes, but Royal had to go to the academy in his fine suit with last year's boots that were slit all around and showed his white socks through. It couldn't be helped. The last morning came. Father and Almanzo did the chores. Every window in the house blazed with candlelight, and Almanzo missed Royal in the barn. Royal and the girls were all dressed up at breakfast. No one ate much. Father went to hitch up, and Almanzo lugged the carpet bags downstairs. He wished Alice wasn't going away. The sleigh bells came jingling to the door, and Mother laughed and wiped her eyes with her apron. They all went out to the sleigh. The horses pawed and shook jingles from their bells. Alice tucked the lap robe over her bulging skirts, and Father let the horses go. The sleigh slid by and turned into the road. Alice's black-veiled face looked back, and she called, "Goodbye! Goodbye!" Almanzo did not like that day much. Everything seemed large and still and empty. He ate dinner all alone with Father and Mother. Chore time was earlier because Royal was gone. Almanzo hated to go into the house and not see Alice. He even missed Eliza Jane. After he went to bed, he lay awake and wondered what they were doing, 5 long miles away. Next morning, the cobbler came. Mother went to the door and said to him, "Well, this is a pretty time to be coming, I must say. 3 weeks late and my children as good as barefoot." But the cobbler was so good-natured that she couldn't be angry long. It wasn't his fault. He'd been kept 3 weeks at one house making shoes for a wedding. The cobbler was a fat, jolly man. His cheeks and his stomach shook when he chuckled. He set up his cobbler's bench in the dining room by the window and opened his box of tools. Already he had Mother laughing at his jokes. Father brought last year's tanned hides, and he and the cobbler discussed them all morning. Dinner time was gay. The cobbler told all the news. He praised Mother's cooking, and he told jokes till Father roared and Mother wiped her eyes. Then the cobbler asked Father what he should make first, and Father answered, "I guess you better begin with boots for Almanzo." Almanzo could hardly believe it. He had wanted boots for so long. He had thought he must wear moccasins until his feet stopped growing so fast. "You'll spoil the boy, James," Mother said. But Father answered, "He's big enough now to wear boots." Almanzo could hardly wait for the cobbler to begin. First the cobbler looked at all the wood in the woodshed. He wanted a piece of maple, perfectly seasoned, and with a straight, fine grain. When he found it, he took his small saw and he sawed off 2 thin slabs. One was exactly 1 inch thick, the other was 1/2 inch thick. He measured and sawed their corners square. He took the slabs to his cobbler's bench and sat down and opened his box of tools. It was divided into little compartments, and every kind of cobbler's tool was neatly laid in them. The cobbler laid the thicker slab of maple wood on the bench before him. He took a long, sharp knife and cut the whole top of the slab into tiny ridges. Then he turned it around and cut ridges the other way, making tiny, pointed peaks. He laid the edge of a thin, straight knife in the groove between two ridges and gently tapped it with a hammer. A thin strip of wood split off, notched all along one side. He moved the knife and tapped it till all the wood was in strips. Then, holding a strip by one end, he struck his knife in the notches, and every time he struck, a shoe peg split off. Every peg was an inch long, an eighth of an inch square, and pointed at the end. The thinner piece of maple he made into pegs, too, and those pegs were half an inch long. Now the cobbler was ready to measure Almanzo for his boots. Almanzo took off his moccasins and his socks and stood on a piece of paper while the cobbler carefully drew around his feet with his big pencil. Then the cobbler measured his feet in every direction and wrote down the figures. He did not need Almanzo any more now, so Almanzo helped Father husk corn. He had a little husking peg, like Father's big one. He buckled the strap around his right mitten, and the wooden peg stood up like a second thumb between his thumb and fingers. He and Father sat on milking stools in the cold barnyard by the corn shocks. They pulled ears of corn from the stalks. They took the strips of the dry husks between thumb and husking pegs and stripped the husks off the ear of corn. They tossed the bare ears into bushel baskets. The stalks and rustling long dry leaves they laid in piles. The young stock would eat the leaves. When they had husked all the corn they could reach, they hitched their stools forward and slowly worked their way deeper into the tasseled shocks of corn. Husks and stalks piled up behind them. Father emptied the full baskets into the corn bins, and the bins were filling up. It was not very cold in the barnyard. The big barns broke the cold winds, and the dry snow shook off the corn stalks. Almanzo's feet were aching, but he thought of his new boots. He could hardly wait till supper time to see what the cobbler had done. That day the cobbler had whittled out two wooden lasts, just the shape of Almanzo's feet. They fitted upside down over a tall peg on his bench, and they would come apart in halves. Next morning the cobbler cut soles from the thick middle of the cowhide and inner soles from the thinner leather near the edge. He cut uppers from the softest leather. Then he waxed his thread. With his right hand, he pulled a length of linen thread across the wad of black cobbler's wax in his left palm, and he rolled the thread under his right palm down the front of his leather apron. Then he pulled it up and rolled it again. The wax made a crackling sound, and the cobbler's hands went out and in, till the thread was shiny black and stiff with wax. Then he laid a stiff hog bristle against each end of it, and he waxed and rolled, till the bristles were waxed fast to the thread. At last he was ready to sew. He laid the upper pieces of one boot together and clamped them in a vise. The edges stuck up, even and firm. With his awl, the cobbler punched a hole through them. He ran the two bristles through the hole, one from each side, and with his strong arms, he pulled the thread tight. He bored another hole, ran the two bristles through it, and pulled till the waxed thread sank into the leather. That was one stitch.
"Now that's a seam," he said. "Your feet won't get damp in my boots, even if you go wading in them. I never sewed a seam yet that wouldn't hold water."
Stitch by stitch he sewed the uppers. When they were done, he laid the soles to soak in water overnight. Next morning, he set one of the lasts on his peg, the sole up. He laid the leather insole on it. He drew the upper part of a boot down over it, folding the edges over the inner sole. Then he laid the heavy sole on top, and there was the boot, upside down on the last. The cobbler bored holes with his awl all around the edge of the sole. Into each hole he drove one of the short maple pegs. He made a heel of thick leather and pegged it in place with the long maple pegs. The boot was done. The damp soles had to dry overnight. In the morning, the cobbler took out the lasts, and with a rasp, he rubbed off the inside ends of the pegs. Almanzo put on his boots. They fitted perfectly, and the heels thumped grandly on the kitchen floor. Saturday morning, Father drove to Malone to bring home Alice and Royal and Eliza Jane to be measured for their new shoes. Mother was cooking a big dinner for them, and Almanzo hung around the gate, waiting to see Alice again. She wasn't a bit changed. Even before she jumped out of the buggy, she cried, "Oh, Almanzo, you've got new boots!" She was studying to be a fine lady. She told Almanzo all about her lessons in music and deportment, but she was glad to be home again. Eliza Jane was more bossy than ever. She said Almanzo's boots made too much noise. She even told Mother that she was mortified because Father drank tea from his saucer. "My land, how else would he cool it?" Mother asked. "It isn't the style to drink out of saucers anymore," Eliza Jane said. "Nice people drink out of the cup." "Eliza Jane!" Alice cried. "Be ashamed. I guess Father's as nice as anybody." Mother actually stopped working. She took her hands out of the dishpan and turned round to face Eliza Jane. "Young lady," she said, "if you have to show off your fine education, you tell me where saucers come from." Eliza Jane opened her mouth and shut it and looked foolish. "They come from China," Mother said. "Dutch sailors brought them from China 200 years ago, the first time sailors ever sailed around the Cape of Good Hope and found China. Up to that time, people drank out of cups. They didn't have saucers. Ever since they've had saucers, they've drunk out of them. I guess a thing that folks have done for 200 years we can keep on doing. And we're not likely to change for a newfangled notion that you've got in Malone Academy." That shut up Eliza Jane. Royal did not say much. He put on old clothes and did his share of the chores, but he did not seem interested. And that night in bed, he told Almanzo he was going to be a storekeeper. "You're a bigger fool than I'd be if you drudge all your days on a farm," he said. "I like horses," said Almanzo. "Huh. Storekeepers have horses," Royal answered. "They dress up every day and keep clean, and they ride around with a carriage and a pair. There's men in the cities have coachmen to drive them." Almanzo did not say anything, but he did not want a coachman. He wanted to break colts, and he wanted to drive his own horses himself. Next morning, they all went to church together. They left Royal and Eliza Jane and Alice at the academy. Only the cobbler came back to the farm. Every day he whistled and worked at his bench in the dining room till all the boots and shoes were done. He was there 2 weeks, and when he loaded his bench and tools in his buggy and drove away to his next customer, the house seemed empty and still again. That evening, Father said to Almanzo, "Well, son, corn husking's done. What say we make a bobsled for Star and Bright tomorrow?"
"Oh, Father!" Almanzo said. Will you let me haul wood from the timber this winter?"
Father's eyes twinkled. "What else would you need a bobsled for?" he asked. The Little Bobsled. Snow was falling next morning when Almanzo rode with Father to the timber lot. Large feathery flakes made a veil over everything. And if you were alone and held your breath and listened, you could hear the soft, tiny sound of their falling. Father and Almanzo tramped through the falling snow in the woods, looking for straight, small oaks. When they found one, Father chopped it down. He chopped off all the limbs, and Almanzo piled them up neatly. Then they loaded the small logs on the bobsled. After that, they looked for two small crooked trees to make curved runners. They must be 5 inches through and 6 feet tall before they began to curve. It was hard to find them. In the whole timber lot, there were no two trees alike.
You wouldn't find two alike in the whole world, son, Father said. Not even two blades of grass are the same. Everything is different from everything else if you look at it.
They had to take two trees that were a little alike. Father chopped them down, and Almanzo helped load them on the bobsled. Then they drove home in time for dinner. That afternoon, Father and Almanzo made a little bobsled on the big barn floor. First, Father hewed the bottoms of the runners flat and smooth, clear around the crook of their turned-up front ends. Just behind the crook, he hewed a flat place on top, and he hewed another flat place near the rear ends. Then he hewed two beams for cross pieces. He hewed them 10 inches wide and 3 inches high and sawed them 4 feet long. They were to stand on edge. He hewed out their corners to fit over the flat places on top of the runners. Then he hewed out a curve in their underneath edges to let them slip over the high snow in the middle of the road. He laid the runners side by side, 3.5 feet apart, and he fitted the cross beams on them. But he did not fasten them together yet. He hewed out two slabs 6 feet long and flat on both sides. He laid them on the cross beams over the runners. Then with the auger, he bored a hole through a slab, down past the crossbeam, into the runner. He bored close to the beam, and the auger made half an auger hole down the side of the beam. On the other side of the beam, he bored another hole like the first. Into the holes he drove stout wooden pegs. The pegs went down through the slab and into the runner, and they fitted tightly into the half holes on both sides of the beam. Two pegs held the slab and the beam and the runner firmly together at one corner of the sled. In the other three corners, he bored the holes, and Almanzo hammered in the pegs. That finished the body of the little bobsled. Now Father bored a hole crosswise in each runner, close to the front crossbeam. He hewed the bark from a slender pole and sharpened its ends so that they would go into the holes. Almanzo and Father pulled the curved ends of the runners as far apart as they could, and Father slipped the ends of the pole into the holes. When Almanzo and Father let go, the runners held the pole firmly between them. Then Father bored two holes in the pole close to the runners. They were to hold the sled's tongue. For the tongue, he used an elm sapling, because elm is tougher and more pliable than oak. The sapling was 10 feet long from butt to tip. Father slipped an iron ring over the tip and hammered it down till it fit tightly, 2.5 feet from the butt. He split the butt in two, up to the iron ring, which kept it from splitting any farther. He sharpened the split ends and spread them apart and drove them into the holes in the crosswise pole. Then he bored holes down through the pole into the two ends of the tongue and drove pegs into the holes. Near the tip of the tongue, he drove an iron spike down through it. The spike stuck out below the tongue. The tip of the tongue would go into the iron ring in the bottom of the calf's yoke, and when they backed, the ring would push against the spike, and the stiff tongue would push the sled backward. Now the bobsled was done. It was almost chore time, but Almanzo did not want to leave his little bobsled until it had a wood rack. So Father quickly bored holes down through the ends of the slabs into the cross beams, and into each hole Almanzo drove a stake 4 feet long. The tall stakes stood up at the corners of the sled. They would hold the logs when he hauled wood from the timber. The storm was rising. The falling snow whirled, and the wind was crying with a lonely sound when Almanzo and Father carried the full milk pails to the house that night. Almanzo wanted deep snow so that he could begin hauling wood with the new sled. But Father listened to the storm and said that they could not work outdoors next day. They would have to stay under shelter, so they might as well begin threshing wheat. Threshing. The wind howled and the snow whirled, and a mournful sound came from the cedars. The skeleton apple trees rattled their branches together like bones. All outdoors was dark and wild and noisy. But the solid, strong barns were quiet. The howling storm beat upon them, but the barns stood undisturbed. They kept their own warmth inside themselves. When Almanzo latched the door behind him, the noise of the storm was not so loud as the warm stillness of the barns. The air was quiet. The horses turned in their box stalls and whinnied softly. The colts tossed their heads and pawed. The cows stood in a row, placidly swinging their tasseled tails. You could hear them chewing their cuds. Almanzo stroked the soft noses of the horses and looked longingly at the bright-eyed colts. Then he went to the tool shed where Father was mending a flail. The flail had come off its handle, and Father had put them together again. The flail was an ironwood stick, 3 feet long and as big around as a broom handle. It had a hole through one end. Its handle was 5 feet long, and one end was a round knob. Father put a strip of cowhide through the hole in the flail and riveted the ends together to make a leather loop. He took another strip of cowhide and cut a slit in each end of it. He put it through the leather loop on the flail. Then he pushed the slits over the knobbed end of the handle. The flail and its handle were loosely held together by the two leather loops, and the flail could swing easily in any direction. Almanzo's flail was just like Father's, but it was new and did not need mending. When Father's flail was ready, they went to the south barn floor. There was still a faint smell of pumpkins, though the stock had eaten them all. A woodsy smell came from the pile of beech leaves, and a dry, strawy smell came from the wheat. Outside, the wind was screeching and the snow was whirling, but the south barn floor was warm and quiet. Father and Almanzo unbound several sheaves of wheat and spread them on the clean wooden floor. Almanzo asked Father why he did not hire the machine that did threshing. 3 men had brought it into the county last fall, and Father had gone to see it. It would thresh a man's whole grain crop in a few days. "Now, that's a lazy man's way to thresh," Father said. "Haste makes waste. But a lazy man'd rather get his work done fast than do it himself. That machine chews up the straw till it's not fit to feed stock, and it scatters grain around and wastes it. All it saves is time, son. And what good is time with nothing to do? You want to sit and twiddle your thumbs all these stormy winter days?" "No," said Almanzo. He'd had enough of that on Sundays. They spread the wheat 2 or 3 inches thick on the floor. Then they faced each other, and they took the handles of their flails in both hands. They swung the flails above their heads and brought them down on the wheat. Father's struck, then Almanzo's, then Father's, then Almanzo's. Thud! 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 It was like marching to the music on Independence Day. It was like beating the drum. Thud! 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 The grains of wheat were shelling from their little husks and sifting down through the straw. A faint, good smell came up from the beaten straw like the smell of the ripe fields in the sun. Before Almanzo tired of swinging the flail, it was time to use the pitchforks. He lifted the straw lightly, shaking it, then pitched it aside. The brown wheat grains lay scattered on the floor. Almanzo and Father spread more sheaves over it, then took up their flails again. When the shelled grain was thick on the floor, Almanzo scraped it aside with a big wooden scraper. All that day the pile of wheat grew higher. Just before chore time, Almanzo swept the floor in front of the fanning mill. Then Father shoveled wheat into the hopper while Almanzo turned the fanning mill's handle. The fans whirred inside the mill. A cloud of chaff blew out its front, and the kernels of clean wheat poured out of its side and went sliding down the rising heap on the floor. Almanzo put a handful into his mouth. They were sweet to chew and lasted a long time. He chewed while he held the grain sacks, and Father shoveled the wheat into them. Father stood the full sacks in a row against the wall. A good day's work had been done. "What say we run some beechnuts through?" Father asked. So they pitched beech leaves into the hopper, and now the whirring fans blew away the leaves, and the three-cornered brown nuts poured out. Almanzo filled a peck measure with them to eat that evening by the heater. Then he went whistling to do the chores. All winter long, on stormy nights, there would be threshing to do. When the wheat was threshed, there would be the oats, the beans, the Canada peas. There was plenty of grain to feed the stock, plenty of wheat and rye to take to the mill for flour. Almanzo had harrowed the fields, he had helped in the harvest, and now he was threshing. He helped to feed the patient cows, and the horses eagerly whinnying over the bars of their stalls, and the hungrily bleating sheep, and the grunting pigs. And he felt like saying to them all, "You can depend on me. I'm big enough to take care of you all." Then he shut the door snugly behind him, leaving them all fed and warm and comfortable for the night, and he went trudging through the storm to the good supper waiting in the kitchen. Christmas. For a long time, it seemed that Christmas would never come. On Christmas, Uncle Andrew and Aunt Delia, Uncle Wesley and Aunt Lindy, and all the cousins were coming to dinner. It would be the best dinner of the whole year, and a good boy might get something in his stocking. Bad boys found nothing but switches in their stockings on Christmas morning. Almanzo tried to be good for so long that he could hardly stand the strain. But at last, it was the day before Christmas, and Alice and Royal and Eliza Jane were home again. The girls were cleaning the whole house, and Mother was baking. Royal helped Father with the threshing, but Almanzo had to help in the house. He remembered the switch and tried to be willing and cheerful. He had to scour the steel knives and forks and polish the silver. He had to wear an apron around his neck. He took the scouring brick and scraped a pile of red dust off it, and then with a wet cloth he rubbed the dust up and down on the knives and forks. The kitchen was full of delicious smells. Newly baked bread was cooling, frosted cakes and cookies and mince pies and pumpkin pies filled the pantry shelves, cranberries bubbled on the stove. Mother was making dressing for the goose. Outdoors, the sun was shining on the snow. The icicles twinkled all along the eaves. Far away, sleigh bells faintly jingled, and from the barns came the joyful thud, 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 thud of the flails. But when all the steel knives and forks were done, Almanzo soberly polished the silver. Then he had to run to the attic for sage. He had to run down cellar for apples and upstairs again for onions. He filled the wood box. He hurried in the cold to fetch water from the pump. He thought maybe he was through then, anyway for a minute. But no, he had to polish the dining room side of the stove. "Do the parlor side yourself, Eliza Jane," Mother said. "Almanzo might spill the blacking." Almanzo's insides quaked. He knew what would happen if Mother knew about that black splotch hidden on the parlor wall. He didn't want to get a switch in his Christmas stocking, but he would far rather find a switch there than have Father take him to the woodshed. That night everyone was tired, and the house was so clean and neat that nobody dared touch anything. After supper, Mother put the stuffed fat goose and the little pig into the heater's oven to roast slowly all night. Father set the dampers and wound the clock. Almanzo and Royal hung clean socks on the back of a chair, and Alice and Eliza Jane hung stockings on the back of another chair. Then they all took candles and went to bed. It was still dark when Almanzo woke up. He felt excited, and then he remembered that this was Christmas morning. He jerked back the covers and jumped onto something alive that squirmed. It was Royal. He had forgotten that Royal was there, but he scrambled over him, yelling, "Christmas! Christmas! Merry Christmas!" He pulled his trousers over his nightshirt. Royal jumped out of bed and lighted the candle. Almanzo grabbed the candle, and Royal shouted, "Hi, leave that be! Where's my pants?" But Almanzo was already running downstairs. Alice and Eliza Jane were flying from their room, but Almanzo beat them. He saw his sock hanging all lumpy. He set down the candle and grabbed a sock. The first thing he pulled out was a cap. A button cap! The plaid cloth was machine-woven. So was the lining. Even the sewing was machine sewing, and the earmuffs were buttoned over the top. Almanzo yelled. He had not even hoped for such a cap. He looked at it inside and out. He felt the cloth and the sleek lining. He put the cap on his head. It was a little large because he was growing, so he could wear it a long time. Eliza Jane and Alice were digging into their stockings and squealing, and Royal had a silk muffler. Almanzo thrust his hand into his sock again and pulled out a nickel's worth of whorehound candy. He bit off the end of one stick. The outside melted like maple sugar, but the inside was hard and could be sucked for hours. Then he pulled out a new pair of mittens. Mother had knit their wrists and backs in a fancy stitch. He pulled out an orange, and he pulled out a little package of dried figs, and he thought that was all. He thought no boy ever had a better Christmas. But in the toe of the sock, there was still something more. It was small and thin and hard. Almanzo couldn't imagine what it was. He pulled it out, and it was a jackknife. It had four blades. Almanzo yelled and yelled. He snapped all the blades open, sharp and shining, and he yelled, "Alice, look! Look, Royal! Looky! Looky, my jackknife! Looky, my cap!" Father's voice came out of the dark bedroom and said, "Look at the clock." They all looked at one another. Then Royal held up the candle, and they looked at the tall clock. Its hands pointed to 3:30. Even Eliza Jane did not know what to do. They had waked up Father and Mother 1.5 hours before time to get up. "What time is it?" Father asked. Almanzo looked at Royal. Royal and Almanzo looked at Eliza Jane. Eliza Jane swallowed and opened her mouth, but Alice said, "Merry Christmas, Father! Merry Christmas, Mother! It's 4:30, Father!" The clock said, "Tick-tock, tick-tock, tick." Then Father chuckled. Royal opened the dampers of the heater, and Eliza Jane stirred up the kitchen fire and put the kettle on. The house was warm and cozy when Father and Mother got up, and they had a whole hour to spare. There was time to enjoy the presents. Alice had a gold locket, and Eliza Jane had a pair of garnet earrings. Mother had knitted new lace collars and black lace mitts for them both. Royal had the silk muffler and a fine leather wallet. But Almanzo thought he had the best presents of all. It was a wonderful Christmas. Then Mother began to hurry, and to hurry everyone else. There were the chores to do, the milk to skim, the new milk to strain and put away, breakfast to eat, vegetables to be peeled, and the whole house must be put in order and everybody dressed up before the company came. The sun rushed up the sky. Mother was everywhere, talking all the time. Almanzo, wash your ears. Goodness mercy, Royal, don't stand around underfoot. Eliza Jane, remember, you're paring those potatoes, not slicing them, and don't leave so many eyes they can see to jump out of the pot. Count the silver, Alice, and piece it out with the steel knives and forks. The best bleached tablecloths are on the bottom shelf. Oh, mercy, honest, look at that clock. Sleigh bells came jingling up the road, and Mother slammed the oven door and ran to change her apron and pin on her brooch. Alice ran downstairs, and Eliza Jane ran upstairs. Both of them told Almanzo